welcome to episode 56 of Anime Pacific. My name is Alex, and I am not here. Yes, you see, Dane and I are recording the show separately, so for the majority of the show, you will be hearing Dane doing the show solo. Now, this is because of an unfortunate conflict in schedules. We tried to get a show out last weekend, trying to keep up with our schedule of regularly pumping out those episodes every week, but unfortunately, Dane, on the day that we were supposed to record the show, slept in till almost noon. And when he came on, he apologized and said, "Oh, Alex, I'm sorry, I slept in, I can't record the show, and I have to run now to go to a meeting with my friend. So screw the fans, I'd rather sleep than record. Never mind, those bloody Anime World Order, they put out a show once a month, so the hell with it." That was his answer, and of course I heroically offered to wake up at 4 in the morning sometime during this week to record so we could get the show out, but Dane said, I can't very well ask you to wake up at 4 a.m. when I couldn't even haul my ass out of bed before noon, so you don't have to do that. So I didn't take him up on my own suggestion there. So we're going to have to resort to doing it this way. A little bit odd. I have no idea what Dana's planned for this week's show. But I have some comments and some things to point out.
In case you don't know, I'm Dane Scaresbrook, and this is Anipac, or Anime Pacific, which is originally based around anime, but we cover a whole heap of stuff, mostly about Asian entertainment and a little bit of politics also. So if that's not for you, well, there are plenty of other great anime podcasts out there that stay on topic, but we always don't, okay? But give it a try and you might enjoy it. Anyway, it's a good thing that Alex isn't here today because I have somewhat of a long review, which I've been dying to do for a long time, but Alex and his infamous lack of an attention span for anything greater than 15 minutes for a review. So today I'm going to be talking about Dominion, aka Dominion Tank Police. Now, this was recently featured in the Buried Treasures column of Anime News Network, and it was also reviewed a while ago on Geek Nights. However, neither of these have taken both anime OVA series and both manga series into account. I will probably won't even mention the new OVA series, which is not is Dominion in name only, really. It was not the best adaptation, but I'll get to that later on. If you have any emails or questions or comments you want to leave, then please email us at animepacific@gmail.com. Yes, we have changed our email address. That's gmail.com. Yahoo was filling up with spam, and the dubious places that Alex usually visits most likely have infected his computer with some adware, so we're getting lots and lots of strange emails at our Yahoo account. We still do check the Yahoo account, just in case some people have been left behind, and we will always remind those people to email us at our Gmail account. So, big thanks to Regan of Anime 82 fame, which is a very excellent new podcast, and already up to quite a few episodes, so that he's pumping them out at a respectable rate. And he helped us with episode 55 because Gcast, where I normally host the files, was taking a crap and it wasn't working, and he suggested another place to host the files. So perhaps without him, there might not be an episode 55, let alone an episode 56. For those of you that are in the mood for something anime-related, stick around. For those of you that miss the humorous and somewhat immature hijinks of our normal show, which this most certainly is not a normal episode, then you should check out our episode 55. We're rather proud of that one. It was over 2 hours in length. And check out, hopefully, regarding side updates, you have probably seen, if you do visit our website, don't just get our show off a podcatcher or iTunes or something, then you have probably seen that our website over the past month or so has gone through various changes aesthetically, as well as certain little links and functionally. And before it was criticized for looking a bit like Pepto-Bismol, recently, because I felt that the original design that I made about a year ago now was looking a little bit cluttered. So I have since been tinkering with it, and I've got a pretty final design up there. It's not meant to be epically beautiful by any stretch of the imagination, but it's meant to be at least not a strain on the eyes and do the job. I mean, this is a audio entertainment, so we're not focusing so much on the visuals. But you should check it out at www.animepacific.blogspot.com and leave a comment. The comments tab is now at the top of each episode, not at the bottom like before. So if you had trouble finding it, that's why. And as we mentioned the last episode, a jolly good fan of ours created an Anime Pacific Facebook page. And he's done a really good job. And there, me and Alex said that we would join when there's a few more people there, because it's a little bit sad if, you know, there's two people in there and then we join. And hey, but so far some more people have joined. In fact, double the amount before. We now have four people in there. So if you want to join it, then please do. I will leave the link in the show note. In fact, I'll probably make a permanent link somewhere on the website there. And if you want to add yourself, and when there's a few more people, me and Alex will feel that we have enough dignity to enter and join up also. So please check that link out, and we can have more direct contact with our beloved fans. And of course, if you don't want to do that, that's fine. You can also email us or leave comments. Our comment section is pretty busy at times and pretty dead at other times. So just leave some messages, and me and Alex always reply, especially me, and Alex will reply most of the time also.
Hello, my name is Regan Strongblood. Let me ask you a few questions to see if you qualify as one of the mighty individuals who may enjoy my new anime review podcast, Anime 82.
Has Del Sarat possessed your soul, leading you to demon bloodlust? Do you agree that Binu from Anime Genesis sounds like a stone surfer? Do you imagine that Dane from Anime Pacific, when he's talking, is Baby Stewie from Family Guy, and that his co-host Alex is Norm MacDonald? Maybe you're jealous that those guys from Destroy All Podcast DX have the new gold latent figure and you don't. Perhaps Dave and Joel's new episode hasn't come out yet.
Are you a real manly geek with mecha balls?
Perhaps you cry yourself to sleep, knowing Galaxy Express 3-9 will never be released, the TV series I'm talking about. Or perhaps you just enjoy old school anime, then come check out my anime review show at anime82.blogspot.com. That's anime82, 82 as in the number, .blogspot.com.
Anime 82, bringing you back to the golden age of anime and beyond.
Now, the other thing I wanted to talk about, which, you know, I guess normally I wouldn't sort of mention the PBS show Nova, although I do watch it regularly, but it's just not, you know, cool enough or something to watch to sort of say that I'm watching. But I was watching it, I taped it a couple days ago, and they had this fascinating look at how smart, like, chimps are and the latest research. And I just had to bring up this example, a couple of examples, because I just thought it was just so great. And if you can watch Nova this week about this chimp show, I'm sure maybe it's online somewhere, or you can still catch it in reruns this week. God knows PBS seems to run the same show over and over again. Here's the setup. They have this, you know, chimp in a cage, a big cage, filled with the usual stuff, you know, water, there's like a tree in the background, you know. It's a cage for chimps. And they set up a clear plastic tube that's attached to the ground so that the chimp can't lift it up, and then it has a bottom. Okay, and the chimp can stick his hand down this tube, but he can't stick it down all the way. And at the bottom of this tube, they put some peanuts. And this, they did not train him to fish out the peanuts or anything. They just presented the chimp with this problem. You know, he can see these peanuts, but he can't, his hand can't reach down to pick them up because it doesn't fit all the way down this tube. So how do you think the chimp got the friggin' peanuts out of this tube? Keeping in mind, the chimp can't, like, physically pick up this tube and move it around. It's attached to the floor. Now, think about this for a minute, because the friggin' chimp, you know, this solution is going to blow you away. Now, I wonder, this would be so much better if I could ask Dane if he could figure this out. Dane, can you figure this out? How did the chimp get the friggin' peanuts out of the tube? Well, I'll tell you. What a solution. And this is not taught. He had to figure this friggin' thing out himself. The chimp, you know, after sort of thinking for a while, you know, he sort of went away, and then he came back, and then he went over to his water, sucked in some water, went over to the tube, spit the friggin' water into the tube. The peanuts floated on the surface of the water. He went back, you know, to get more water, went back to the tube, spit some more water into the tube. The peanuts floated up the tube, and he just stuck his hand down, picked them up, and ate them. Isn't that friggin' brilliant? I would have never thought of that. I mean, and to be honest, I wonder how many in the audience thought of that. It was, I couldn't believe it. I was blown away. So, yeah, outsmarted by a chimp, you know. It's just fast. What a fascinating show. And the whole show is sort of filled with examples like this. I'll give you another example. They sort of an experiment to see how, you know, see if chimps can learn from other chimps, because they talked about how there are actually some chimps that actually use tools. Like they didn't know this like 20 years ago. This is only recently discovered. These chimps actually take sticks and they sharpen the end of a stick to sort of make them into spears, and they use it to, you know, poke down holes and kill animals. It's friggin' unbelievable. So they're actually using tools. And it used to be Sarah said that only humans could use, you know, definition of human. Well, we can use tools and no other animals can use tools. Well, these guys are using tools. So at any rate, this other experiment, you know, how did, you know, the chimps sort of pass on this knowledge? Well, you know, essentially that they just, like, you know, they watch and they learn, although they're not necessarily taught. But they know that they're very good observers. They watch and they learn. So they had this sort of, as an experiment, they built this sort of contraption, sort of a clear plastic box almost. And it had all these sort of wheels, sort of plates that sort of spin around with holes in them, and a lever. And the scientist would put in a grape at the into sort of a tube that sort of fed into this clear box, and the grape would fall into this sort of platform, and you have to sort of spin this platform around until the hole lined it up with this tube to enable the grape to fall to the next level, and then you had to pull this lever in order to have the grape sort of come down out of the chute, and you know, and then you could eat it, have access to it. And of course, you know, the chimp isn't going to be able to figure this out on his own. It's quite complicated. So the scientist takes one of these chimps, pulls him aside out of the group, and sort of hidden from the other chimps can't see. He teaches him how to use this contraption. He shows him how to use it. And, you know, then he knows how to use it. And then he puts the chimp back into, you know, Gen Pop. And puts this contraption down, and, you know, immediately so the chimp goes over to it. He's, you know, he's hungry. He wants some grapes, and of course, you know, he goes over to it. He spins, you know, he spins this little wheel around, and it lines up the hole, and then the grape falls down. He pulls the lever, and the chute opens up, and then he eats the food, and he's the only chimp that knows how to do this, mind. And the other chimps are watching him, and he, you know, this chimp does it a couple times. And pretty soon, another chimp runs over, shoves this other chimp out of the way, like literally, like pushes him away from the box. He runs right over, shoves him out of the way, like, get out of the way, I want to eat. And he, you know, spins the little wheel, pulls the lever, and he gets his grape. And then, you know, other chimps come over and they start all doing this. So it was hilarious. So all the this chimp, you know, they learned just by watching this other chimp and how to get his food. I thought it was hilarious. It was the funniest scene, this footage of the chimp is like sort of minding his own business, trying to get the grapes. And the chimp runs right over, shoves him out of the way. I want to eat now, kind of thing. And he immediately, you know, starts playing with it and getting his grape. It was amazing. And then, you know, there's one big cage. There was another cage across the way where other chimps were sort of looking at this action. So as an experiment, you know, the scientists came over. They took this sort of contraption. They brought it over to the other cage sort of across the way, and he plopped it down in the middle of the room. And immediately those chimps, you know, started, you know, working it correctly and getting the grapes. And keep in mind, you know, this is something, you know, complicated enough that a chimp would not be able to figure out on his own. Hell, looking at that thing, I probably have problems figuring out how to work it. And these guys, just by looking at, you know, observing, they learned how to do it. So I thought it was a fascinating, fascinating show. It was funny and just interesting looking at all these experiments and how smart these chimps are. You know, smarter than you thought. And they sort of compared, you know, they had like a three-year-old boys and girls, and they showed now in some cases that these chimps are actually smarter than these three-year-old boys and girls. So I thought, yeah, because they conducted the same experiments on you know, both groups. So I highly recommend it, this Nova thing on chimps. You can check your local listings, but it is available online at the Nova website. I'm sure Dane will link to it. It's called Ape Genius. I highly recommend watching it. Check it out. It's free to watch online. Totally legal download at the PBS Nova website.
It's just as I've always said, Alex has quite a passion for chimps, and now you know too.
Now, the reason that we have been able to get together to do the show this week is that the last couple weekends I've been busy. Last weekend I went to Vancouver. It's part of my work at the railway. And do some training. You know, of course, I had some time to do some sort of minor sightseeing. And the thing that strikes you immediately when you're in Vancouver is that, you know, it's got to be like 60% of the population are, you know, it's Asians. It's like, it is like being in Hong Kong or hell, Japan, because I think, you know, walking around there, at least half of the people I heard talking, they were speaking Japanese. I was really surprised. So I think Kaori, you know, if we ever ended up living in Vancouver, would fit right in, because God, so many, you know, tall buildings, you know, it is. It's like Hong Kong, sort of a Hong Kong-style public transit system, as we mentioned in the last show. And just, you know, the language, and you hear a lot of Cantonese, and I heard, at least when I was there, just tons of Japanese spoken everywhere. So very interesting. And then now this weekend, we have been able to get together to the show, because I'll be in Winnipeg for several weeks, maybe even a couple months. My company, they've got a shortage of employees there. So as a junior man, we're all getting sent all over the country. Yeah, Edmonton, Prince George, and Winnipeg, which is what I chose because I got relatives in the area. So this Friday and Saturday, my wife and I will be traveling to Winnipeg, where when I checked yesterday, it was friggin' minus 30. Minus 30, that's centigrade. And with the wind chill, it was like minus 45. And here it's, you know, like just, you know, about 0 degrees, eh? Minus one, plus one. So, and hell, in Vancouver, it was like almost 10 degrees. So it's going to be quite the difference. Although the weather forecast, apparently it's supposed to warm up in Winnipeg, so that's good. And the company is putting me up in a really nice hotel. Like, well, it's Best Western, but it's like a suites. So we got like it's like a suite. So it has like a bed. It's like a it has a bedroom. It has a little kitchen, and you know, sort of a little living room area. So with high speed internet and it's got a fitness center and a swimming pool. So it's quite nice actually. So you know, it's pretty good.
And regarding the Edison scandal that we talked about last week, which, I don't know, some of you might have ended up looking up some of those pictures if you so desired, and some of you might have just not cared because you might not be into that sort of the whole Hong Kong entertainment industry, but I think a lot of anime fans are more likely to be, and, you know, we're Pacific as well as anime, as we always annoyingly say to you. So what has since happened then? Well, it's been a little bit pushed out of the headlines because, and I'm a huge Hong Kong cinema fan, that the famous Lydia Shum, who's also known as Feifei, which translates as Fat Fat, which she was affectionately known as, passed away at the age of 63. Now, she was pretty huge in Asia, and if you're a Hong Kong film fan, I'm sure you'd recognize her face. She was, you know, quite large and tubby, and she eternally had her hair in kind of a 1960s style, and she had those sort of glasses, which you might also have expected in the 60s. And part of the reason is because, well, she's been acting since she was a kid, and she sort of just kept that look for the whole time, and she was very well loved by everyone in Hong Kong and I'm sure in other places in the world. And yeah, she passed away of some sort of liver cancer, and it was really tragic because over the last few months, you saw her, and she was it's always, you know, fat and cuddly and sort of cute, and she was a comedian most of the time, and the cancer just made her really thin, which didn't look natural, especially for her, and it was rather heartbreaking. So most of Hong Kong TV at the moment is dominated by tributes and things like that for Feifei. And the whole weekend, they're going to be showing all sorts of films from starring Feifei. So that kind of pushed the Edison thing out of the headlines. However, regarding that, he did finally come back to Hong Kong, because as of last week, he did not come back to Hong Kong. Some people thought he might never will. He was actually sort of hiding in Boston, and he did come back and held a press conference. I think it was 2 days ago, and in the press conference, he basically said that he's still helping police, he's sorry, blah 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 blah, and that he would be stepping down from the Hong Kong entertainment industry, which is pretty huge. And he said he will honor all the commitments up to that, you know, that he has already committed to, signed contracts for, etc. But after that, he's stepping down. Of course, the word on the street is that while he was in America, mysteriously, he was interviewing lots of people in Hollywood, which is no surprise, really. He's using all his star power that he's accumulated to try and get some roles in Hollywood. Now, I know, in fact, he's already got some roles. He's going to be in the next Batman film. I know he filmed, because some of that was filmed in Hong Kong here. And I remember when everyone was saying, oh, they're filming some Batman here, and on Tuesday they're going to actually have the Batman plane in the sky, which is what the producers told them. So the news went all wild over that, and lots of Batman, because Batman is pretty huge here. In fact, a lot of superhero films are pretty huge here. And so I think some people even took the day off from work to go to the location, I think it was around Chim Sha Tsui or something, where they were going to see the supposedly the Batman plane. And it turns out it was in fact like Bruce Wayne's private jet that they were filming, not the Batman plane. So everyone was heartbroken and disappointed and probably didn't even realize one of the planes they saw was the Bruce Wayne's private plane. And anyway, Edison is also in that, and of course he's probably well known for his role in Mogando. I mean, well known internationally in more non-Asian areas for his role in Mogando 2, which is Infernal Affairs 2, which got adapted into a Hollywood film also, which I didn't see. So I think either way, he doesn't really care so much if people don't kind of forgive him. But meanwhile, the Gillian from Twins, who we also talked about, since went public and said, "Oh, I'm so innocent and naive, and I didn't know, and I loved him, and I only opened my legs up and showed my clitoris to half the world because I loved him," which made all the Moe fans go, "Oh, poor Gillian." But at the same time, there's still a bit of an outcry. And there's also rumors that she's married someone suddenly, who's a singer called Juno, who's basically this sort of spoiled little rich kid. And I think her management has said that they're going to hold on to her contract and see if people forget about this scandal, and if so, then things will go on as normal, and if not, they might let her go. And regarding Cecilia Chung Pak Chi, who is probably the most infamous now on the internet because of her extremely skanky pictures, she has since, it's been said that her husband, Nicholas Dare, who is kind of Edison's rival, ironically, there was a film, for example, Generation X Cops, which Nicholas starred in, and then the sequel, Generation Y Cops, or Gen Y Cops, Edison starred in to replace him. So, and I know they went to the same secondary school or something like that, so there's a bit of rivalry there. But he has been seen without wearing the wedding ring, and it turns out that he's doing a paternity test on his son to see if it really is his son. And at the same time, he sort of said, "Well, look, how have you done this before?" And then she, apparently, Cecilia Jung is now pregnant again, and he is almost definitely not the father. And so he said, "Look, how many people are you doing this with?" And she said, "Oh, well, 4 or 5. At the moment, it's confirmed to be about 3. So, it just goes to show that, well, I mean, she never had sort of the innocent persona that everyone imagined. You know, everyone kind of knew what she was like. But to do that when you're married, I think, is absolutely disgusting and atrocious. And, I don't know, just really, really hoary and skanky is all I can say. And I don't use those Jerry Springer-esque words much, but I just can't believe it. And lots of people before were saying, "Oh, well, you know, Hong Kong stars are much purer than those in Hollywood who are always getting divorced and, you know, getting involved in drugs and blah, 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 blah." Well, at least you know that wealth and power corrupts in pretty much anywhere in the world, I suppose. Although I'm sure if I was a star, I'd be one of those, like that guy from Virgin who's always doing interesting stuff and donating to charities. I'm sure I'd be one of those lovely fellows. The uploader of those pictures of Edison, who promised to upload a video later, has since been very silent. Police are still arresting some people, but I think they have discovered that the law regarding explicit content is not very clear-cut, and they want to amend the ordinance, because right now they can't keep all these people because, you know, yeah, I uploaded the picture, but what can you do? Nothing. So they've been letting a lot of people off. And I think it's a bit, I usually defend the Hong Kong police because I think they've got one of the best police forces in the world right now, especially in the last 20 years since the ICAC came in. But it's all, you know, "Oh, celebrities, quick. Let's use all our taxpayers' money."
Hey guys, we have to tape a promo for our show. In 20 seconds, tell us what the Anime Roundtable is about.
Well, the Roundtable is about a Canadian perspective on issues revolving around anime, manga, and fandom. As well, we got the bullets, and why not some final insults to send it all off.
5 seconds left.
Really?
Lollies, Nazis, train molesters, bakake, and the women that love them.
Time's up.
Are we allowed to say that?
Well, it is uncensored. It's the Anime Roundtable, the official podcast of Anime North. Look for us on iTunes, Podcast Pickle, or your favorite podcast directory. Or look us up online, www.animeroundtable.com. The Anime Roundtable, where we edit for time, not content.
So, some interesting stuff this week at Japan Probe, which we talk a lot about the stuff that they post there. We try to keep stuff diverse and not just reading off Anime News Network. First thing is a volunteer Shibuya patrol in Japan. Basically a group of volunteers who have no affiliation with the police get together and patrol the streets of Shibuya and enact their brand of justice across Shibuya. And among the videos, and there are more at Japan Probe, www.japanprobe.com, awesome blog slash website slash video postings. And yeah, the video involves yelling at people who are leaning against rails or sitting down on a stair, on a step out of people's way, and generally being power-hungry vigilantes. And it's a little bit scary that they're even allowed to do this, because I thought vigilantism is kind of supposed to be not exactly legal. And I know I've also seen videos of these vigilantes in places in Texas and places near Mexico where they're running around at the border with guns trying to stop Mexicans going in. And I don't know, I just don't know why the police allow this sort of thing. They certainly wouldn't here in Hong Kong. And it's just that the things that these guys are stopping people for is very amusing, to say the least. Included in some of these videos, and I won't post them all, are patrolmen telling a restaurant mascot to bugger off because he's being a nuisance to pedestrians. You know, a lot of restaurants in Japan and pretty much everywhere in the world, but especially Japan, they might have like a cute little octopus guy in an octopus suit, you know, outside a octopus ball store. And some other ones were people who they deemed to be looking suspicious. And they do kind of look suspicious, but or that they look shady. But, I mean, who is it for us, not the police, to determine that? And they're holding bags, and they're refusing to move when they're told they shouldn't just stand around in the street. The men state they're doing nothing wrong, and I agree with them. I mean, the contents of the bag might be suspect, but just standing around the street is doing nothing wrong. So, and a reporter asked them why they refused to move. The men said they didn't feel they're doing any crime. So, you know, from that point of view, I agree with them. And, of course, there is the obligatory evil gaijin with the cigarette. In fact, it's one of those Nigerians who are on a loitering visa, I suspect, that me and Alex have talked about a lot in the past. In case you don't know or you haven't listened to that episode, that a lot of places in the trendy areas and the fashion districts, they'll have sort of a hip-hop themed shop, and they'll have a black guy out the front. And you might think he's from South Central LA or something, but when you hear them speak, it's very clear that they're from Africa, most probably Nigeria, from what I've determined. So, yeah, the guy is standing out. I guess he's standing out the front of one of those sort of shops that we talk about, with a cigarette in his hand, and they're telling him that he shouldn't be doing that. Now, while I think everyone is well within their right to tell someone to stop smoking, because I sympathize with these vigilantes on this one point. I hate people who walk down the street and smoke in front of me, and I have to smell their smoke. I think they're the most selfish scumbags in the world. And were I emperor of the world, I would have all those people gassed. Yeah, I know that sounds controversial, but I just hate people screwing my health up and the health of other people around them just because they want to have a smoke while they're walking down the street and blowing their smoke all around. Luckily, as of January 2007. Yeah, it's been more than a year now. Hong Kong had a law where you cannot smoke in restaurants anymore, which is a godsend for me because I love going around and eating in all the different sort of places, and it is always completely ruined when some dickwad is smoking and we all have to smell it. So now in parks, public areas like the beach, parks, restaurants, people aren't allowed to smoke anymore. But still, when you're walking down the street, especially Mong Kok, which is the huge busy shopping district, there are always people smoking, and I pray for their death. So anyway, and you know, if you're a listener and you smoke, that's your own choice, as stupid as it may be. But I've got nothing against people who smoke per se, you know, as long as you don't affect other people with your smoke. Now, speaking of smoking, in mainland China, where I would guess that about 90% of men there smoke, there's certain concern that was raised in a Japanese newspaper about the quality of toilets in China during the Beijing Olympics. And this is somewhat relevant to my life, not here in Hong Kong, obviously, but it has been relevant to past experiences. And this is not the first time I've talked about toilets in China, like the infamous Harbin Zoo story. But in this article, they're basically saying that North China is still dominated by sort of squatting-style toilets. Now, Japan has plenty of these also, actually, so I don't know what the big fuss about the style of toilet is. And actually, once you get to know those squatting-style toilets, they're actually kind of better in a way, because who wants to actually sit on a chair where thousands of derrieres have rubbed all over? But with these squatting ones, especially if it's clean, it's heaven, where you just squat and you don't have to worry about any of that rubbish. And also, it kind of, from an environmental point of view, and this is not, I don't want this to get too graphic, but kind of the position you are sitting in and the position that what needs to happen happens eliminates a greater need for toilet paper, because you might not realize, but the way we kind of sit down on a toilet and do our business is not the best way, because I don't know how to explain this. It's like having a jar of tar and pouring... No, it's like having a plastic bottle full of tar and pouring that plastic bottle out. And because of the shape of a plastic... Oh, shit. No, I can't explain this. Basically, all I'm saying is that it is less likely that stuff will get wedged in between your butt cheeks if you are squatting because of the position for the projectile to shoot in. Okay, and I'm not good at being coy about these things. Anyway, but the big issue here, and I agree with this one, is about toilet paper. Now, the toilet paper that they use a lot in China, especially North China, because if you go to Guangdong, Guangzhou, it's much more kind of modern and developed, and Shanghai, of course, it's an amazingly modern place, which is both a good and a bad thing. I mean, of course, yes, we want nice, clean toilets, but we want places that retain somewhat of a traditional culture and whatnot, but that's another podcast in itself. But the toilets, the toilet paper is kind of like this rough tree barky kind of paper which does not flush down in toilets. And when I was living in China, in North China, Daqing, which is China's oil center, which is 3 hours from Harbin, Heilongjiang province near Russia. Quite a few Russians in Harbin, but I'll tell that story another time. And the place I was staying at, like a dormitory, they actually gave me two rooms. One was like a bedroom with a carpet, which was nice, and a toilet. And the other one was just kind of a tiled room where I had a chair and the TV and I put the computer. And so one of the other teachers, who was a real dick, who was staying in one of the rooms near us, the woman downstairs sort of got very grumpy because he blocked the toilet and caused a bit of a plumbing problem. And then the boss said, well, look, I know you, I don't expect you guys to know about this, but in future, don't flush your toilet paper down the toilet. You should put it in the basket next to you. And this is the toilet in our bedrooms, you know. I kind of expected this, but the other guy was gobsmacked. I mean, you want me to keep poo in the basket next to... you just can't do that. You can't just put poo in a rubbish bin. It's madness. So that's kind of what is expected. And these toilets here in areas around China, they have got some signs. Please don't flush hand towels and toilet paper. Thanks. So you can just imagine some poor guy from, I don't know, Poland, who is coming for the Olympics, and then he's doing his business, and then he sees a sign, you know, do not flush toilet paper down the toilet. Well, what's he supposed to do? But so that's certainly interesting.
Ow, my Buccaneers! Please join me, Cancer, on the Upper Paddle Podcast. This weekly podcast features geek news, reviews, and rants in the subjects of anime, video games, and movies. I share conspiracy theories, the Smurfs are communists, random facts. There are more bald eagles in the province of British Columbia, Canada, than there are in the entire United States of America, and Podcast Peak gives us the pirate perspective.
Arr, this steering wheel be driving me nuts.
So go to uppapaddle.com or search for uppapaddle in the iTunes directory. Tens of listeners can't be wrong. Pick up a paddle. It will be glorious.
So Toshiba officially announced this week that it's giving up on HD DVD. So loud huzzas all around. The format war is finally over. And I'm sure we're all going to stop downloading illegal high-speed or illegal HD files and all rally around the Blu-ray flag. Yes. yeah, I'm not sure how that's going to work out, but I'm glad that Blu-ray has finally won. Now, the next thing is to wait for is for the profile Blu-ray Profile 2.0 to come out so that you know, you don't have to worry about being missing out on any features. So God knows how long that's going to take. I wonder if Dan has any plans to buy a Blu-ray drive.
A great irony here, I realize, is that back in the 80s, which is probably one of the greatest decades in the history of mankind, my family bought a beta, or as we called it, a beta player, as opposed to a VHS. And of course, as we all know, the beta, or beta, was far superior in terms of the quality of the physical tape itself and the colors and the quality of the recorded video. It was superb. And Sony, who made the beta originally, pretty much failed on the home video market because VHS was kind of a little bit cheaper and easier, and of course it had the support of the porn industry, because to sort of produce beta tapes or to license them or something was more problematic and more expensive than it was for VHS. So then beta became the choice of broadcasters, and it still was until very recently. In fact, in many other countries they still use it. And anyway, the great irony that I was talking about is the fact that HD DVD was backed by Toshiba. This is our sort of format. Whereas Blu-ray has always been a part of Sony. Now, back in the day, when the VHS beta war was still raging, which apparently wasn't that long of a war anyway, while it was still raging, the beta player that I owned was in fact created by Toshiba. They were one of the earliest third-party supporters of the beta. So, you know, it's very interesting how these things go around. So there's a little bit of trivia for you there. And I still remember going to the video shop, and there was one nearby where I used to live that was huge. Maybe not by the standards that people might be used to in the US, but in Australia it was certainly huge. And they had sort of an elevated platform, which was all beta stuff. Oh my goodness, it was just huge. And then downstairs was VHS stuff. So it was one of those ones that catered equally to both people. And as time went by, that the beta section got smaller and smaller, and of course eventually, when they stopped supporting it, it just kind of, they were just ended up selling all of them. So it was a huge shame, and we still have boxes of beta tapes, and they were just so wonderful that you could get an old beta video with crap all over it and play it and it still look beautiful. But I do mourn for the beta. I still mourn to this day.
You know, a bit more on this. The New York Times website has a really interesting article called "Blu-ray Run the Battle, But Now Comes the War," essentially arguing that for, you know, most average people, the, you know, sort of standard DVDs and the DVD players that are priced now under $100 that can upconvert are, you know, they think it's good enough. And when they go into a store and they see like a Blu-ray DVD, $5, $10 more expensive, they, you know, for some reason, you know, won't pay that much for a DVD when they can get the other version, you know, at, you know, $5 less. And plus the Blu-ray players now are $200, $300 more expensive than one of those up-converting DVD players. Now, you and I, Dane, of course, can tell the difference. And, you know, we love our, you know, high def television and, you know, movies in high def. But I don't know, for the average Joe Blow, do they really need it? And they also bring up the fact that, you know, again, downloads are competitors. I mean, and legit ones, not just like the fuzzy gray or black downloads. You know, they mentioned how Apple are releasing movies in HD, and apparently the quality, you know, isn't as good as like a Blu-ray release, but it's better than cable HD. So, yeah, I don't know. It's going to be tough. I think you can maybe link to the article. It's an interesting read.
On a side note, Bandai Visual, who are just business geniuses with their cheap prices, swift releases, and abundance of extras that they include on their DVDs and HD DVDs, have announced they are going to continue releasing Freedom in high definition on HD DVD. Yes, you go, Bandai. As usual, Bandai's soothsayers have given them some more sage advice yet again. But on a positive note, we should be able to be seeing more high-definition anime coming out in North America and hopefully in other markets, because I guess with a niche market like anime, it could really kill a company to choose on one medium or one format, I should say, HD DVD or Blu-ray. So they want to see who the winner is. And I know ADV just recently announced they're going to start releasing stuff in high-def. Which I believe Tengen Toppa Gurren Lagann might be one of them. And that was one of the sort of rhetorical questions I asked, was that, you know, you can download this show in 720p, and it looks fantastic. Why would you wait and pay for the privilege of getting something of a lesser quality? And obviously, from a moral point of view, of course, the answer should always be buy it. But we live in an age where it's easier. If you see a film and you think, oh my gosh, I have to see that, it's easier for you than to, say, order it online, wait for the shipping, pay the money, da-da-da-da-da, or even get up, get dressed, drive or take a bus to the mall, look in the DVD shop, and get it. And of course, when we're talking about niche stuff like foreign films, which is, my ratio of watching non-English speaking films or media to English speaking media is probably, 6 to 1 almost. So a lot of these things are not easily obtainable, or perhaps they're not even officially obtainable in English at all, and it's the work of fan subbers, and I'm not just talking about anime here. We're living in that age where people can just download this stuff super fast. They can see what they want very quick. And that is why Justin Savarkas said that anime is worth nothing. Of course, it's worth something, but because it is just so readily available and just so easily obtainable, what is the value in paying for it? And that is the question that, you know, we are asking these days. Of course, again, from a point of view, from a moral point of view, the answer should always be buying it. And no one knows more about buying anime than me, because one little thing of note that a lot of people don't put into consideration, like all these 16-year-olds, 17-year-olds who are buying their anime DVDs with their pocket money, which is a noble thing to do, is that I did the same thing, but it is in a format that is now very, very, very dead and does not have the longevity that DVD will have. Because, of course, we've got upscaling, we've got the fact that it's already in digital format, the fact that it's animation, so it's going to look sharper at a higher res, but it's not going to be like watching something like Kingdom of Heaven in 180p, where you can see the creases and the individual specks of dirt on Orlando Bloom's skin or something like that. This is animation, and it's going to look sharp, it's going to look better, but it's not really going to be that worth it as opposed to VHS to DVD. So I spent thousands upon thousands of dollars on VHS tapes, especially in the beginning, because I will talk about this in my review, but in the very beginning, I was getting like $5 Australian a week pocket money. This was like when I was 12. And the only way to get anime was imported from the UK. And there was this one shop in all of Sydney that you could buy it from. And it cost $45. So I had to save up $5, what, that's 2.5 months, and I finally was able to get it. And of course, eventually my pocket money went up when I got older to $20 a week, and then I was able to get, and at that stage, Manga Video had opened shop, which is quite a tumultuous run they had, and tapes were even cheaper. But eventually, then there were TV series started to get licensed, and all the good stuff was coming from the US. Also, you know, England and Australia had cut out some stuff, and some stuff wouldn't be obtainable in its full form, and that pissed me off. And then I remember spending, like, what, $390 Australian on Ranma 1/2 Season 1 box set on VHS. And that's how much I could freaking buy the whole damn series with change now on DVD. So, and, you know, I'm not going to say, oh, it's the evil corporation's fault. It's their fault because I spent all this money on them, and then there's a new format, blah, blah, blah. The digital age was something that needed to happen, and I acknowledge that. But the point is that those of us in the early days were quite used to spending an ungodly amount of money on VHS tapes, which were not digital, which were low quality, and we were lucky if we got 3 episodes of a TV series on a cassette. So lots of people these days are like, oh, this sucks, it only has 4 episodes. Oh, I'm downloading. And, you know, if you could just know what it was like back in the quote-unquote old days, you might think differently.
Another piece of semi-big, if not big, news comes from Ain't It Cool News, and it regards the live-action Akira movie. Yeah. Now, we all know how much I'm looking forward to seeing the Robotech movie, which is being produced by Tobey Maguire, and Tobey Maguire is going to star as the lead, you know, much to Dane's dismay, who wants all Asian all the time, but, you know, you can't be happy with everything. And it takes a big star to get a movie going forward. So, that's one thing. Now, Akira is being produced by Leonardo DiCaprio. And as you can guess, that would mean that he would star as, one of the lead actors. Now, he's not going to be Akira. He's going to be Kaneda. He's not Tetsuo. He's Kaneda. Now, apparently, they have a sort of a rumor that the actor who's going to play Tetsuo, is Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Now, you've probably never heard of him, but if you've seen the movie Brick, he was amazing in that movie. And by the way, I highly recommend that movie, Brick. It's like a film noir, but it's a film noir set in high school. So all these sort of like teenage characters are talking in this film noir dialogue, film noir dialogue, and it's really awesome. And like they really, the dialogue is amazing, and the actor, you know, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, he's amazing in it. So I highly recommend Brick. Okay, so it's this guy who's going to be Tetsuo in Akira. So I'm really looking forward to it. He's also going to be, apparently, according to Ain't It Cool News, he's going to be in a movie I've never heard of called Stop Loss, and he's also going to be in G.I. Joe. No, that's interesting. So, yeah, his career is moving forward. So, and I'm sure Dane is going to express his disappointment over the fact that they haven't cast Japanese actors to play the lead. But again, you got to realize this is a Leonardo DiCaprio, big famous movie star. You need a famous movie star producing it and participating in it if you're going to take a big risk. Now, these movies are a risk. You tell me Robotech is not a risk. And of course, now with Transformers, you know, it makes these projects more attractive to studio to finance because it proved kind of 80s nostalgia kind of pays. But Robotech and Akira are not as famous as Transformers. So this will be a big risk. And having a big star attached and having Western actors to star in them makes it more palatable to the studio. So I don't know. I'm excited. Akira live action. Robotech live action. I can't wait. Any thoughts, Dane?
Akira is so huge and instrumental into shaping me that I would... Just the thought of a live action Hollywood Akira makes me want to vomit my intestines up. I just... No. No.
Another thing that came out, well, last Thursday was the long-awaited Indiana Jones 4 trailer or teaser. Now, I gotta say, I was a little bit disappointed. I mean, after seeing that spectacular, sensational, just mind-blowing Star Trek trailer, where, you know, it just gave you enough so that you're dying to see the movie, but, you know, didn't give away too much. I thought this trailer started giving away too much information. You saw too much of the movie. Now Dan's probably gonna have the opposite opinion because he hates those kind of trailers where, you know, or teasers that, you know, when you you don't see any actual footage. But I thought that, I don't know, they needed a little more tease and a little less substance in a way. If you catch my drift. Anyway, I don't know. What do you think, Dan?
Well, I saw the trailer, and I will call it a trailer because I don't think it was a teaser. I think it looks absolutely awesome. I can't wait because I love Indiana Jones, and I wasn't really thinking much about this movie because I just didn't know how close it was to coming into fruition. You know, you hear about production and filming, but I didn't know that they had gotten this far through it. And just to see it, know it's real and it's coming, is awesome. And I love the fact that they play on Indiana Jones' age, or Harrison Ford's age. He's not going to be, you know, still doing the same sort of stuff. Or he does. I mean, he's still very physical in this role, but there's lots of these kind of... you can see that it's harder for him than before. So I'm very excited that the whole spirit of the series, the whole sort of adventure, is still intact. But from the point of view of Alex, who just wanted a teaser, and yeah, as Alex said, I'm not really big into teasers at all, I can see how he would be disappointed with having a certain extent of it spoilt for him. But I mean, between Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade and this one, the internet sort of came up and stuff is much more spoiled than it used to be, because I remember in the olden days the only way to see a trailer was actually go to the cinema, and you know, if you wanted to see a trailer. But these days, of course, you can download it from the different various websites and whatnot. So, and of course, the whole thing about the internet, people chatting and forums and stuff, and even the very existence of websites like Ain't It Cool News, which I go to a lot. Even the existence of such websites, you know, stuff is revealed more to you. And we go into a film these days with, we know what it's about, but we don't exactly know how it ends, perhaps. And even some trailers these days spoil that. So yeah, I don't like too much of it being spoiled, but I mean, I kind of knew a little bit about what it was about, because I mean, we at least want to know what the setting is, right? You know, is it in Asia? Is it going to be in Europe? Is it going to be what? Now that much is, well, actually in the trailer it doesn't even reveal that much, but I can get a pretty fair idea of it. Now there's also doomsayers, although to a certain less extent, but there's a feeling of negativity from some people saying, oh, you know, George Lucas, he ruined the Star Wars trilogy. And I'm one of the people with the school of thought that he didn't ruin the Star Wars trilogies at all. And the various... the whole nostalgia aspect of the original Star Wars trilogy has clouded people's vision. And I remember in Internet Movie Database, in the forums there, there's one guy who frequently posts in the Star Wars areas, who was a defender of the prequel trilogies, and his signature is similar to Darth Vader's line in Return of the Jedi, and it goes something along the lines of remove this prequel mask of nostalgia and let me see the prequels with my own eyes, or something like that. Remove this mask of nostalgia and let me see the prequel series with my own eyes, or something, because nostalgia has just... You know, all these nostalgia films are coming back, and I think the problem is that nostalgia definitely adds something to a film. It makes it more special in a certain sense, and we're more willing to forgive any flaws in them. But I mean, okay, I'll admit, The Phantom Menace was certainly the least of all the Star Wars films. Okay, I'm not disputing that. I think Attack of the Clones was fantastic and on the levels of all the other Star Wars films. And I think Revenge of the Sith is my favorite Star Wars film. And remember, I don't even remember loving Star Wars. When I first started loving Star Wars, I always did. Because I was born in May the 27th, 1980, and that was the day that Empire Strikes Back was unleashed upon the world. And then, of course, I remember seeing Return of the Jedi at the cinemas when I was 3 in 1983. And I always remember loving Star Wars. So to say that Revenge of the Sith is my favorite one is not something to be taken lightly. I'm not some 12-year-old who just saw it and has not seen any of the other films, or I'm saying, oh, the special effects sucks, George Lucas should remake the original trilogy, lols. I'm not one of those people at all. So that's just my few cents. I love that song. Dominion holds a special place in my heart, especially the first OVA, Dominion Tank Police, because as many older school anime fans have probably experienced, that one of the first anime they saw would probably be Akira, or at least the first thing which was quote-unquote anime. In fact, I've been watching it all my life without exactly realizing or putting a name to it, so to speak, such as Astro Boy and Macross, also known as Robotech, of course, and Battle of the Planets, which was Gatchaman back then, of course. And I remember getting this, and I was probably expecting Akira-quality animation, a dark, gritty cyberpunk setting, and epic music, and when I put it in the VHS player, and back then my pocket money, I was very, like 13 or 12, my allowance, as you Americans would say, was $5 Australian a week. And back then, Australia being an absolute crap country for any niche, nerdy thing, everything's got to be mainstream or not at all. I mean, look at the in an Australian newspaper and see the ratings, and all the top 10 shows are like gardening shows and stuff like that, or very, very crappy shows. But anything niche, sci-fi or fantasy, was almost non-existent. I mean, it's just such a small country that there wasn't enough of a market for it. Now that anime has become a sizably bigger niche, now anime has taken off better in Australia now. In fact, Madman, the distributor, is considered one of the best in the world, and I know some of their transfers are more superior to, say, ones in North America, And some American fans actually import them from Australia. I remember the Evangelion movie apparently had a fantastic transfer for Mad Men. Anyway, on to the review itself. Now, as I've said, it appeared very recently as to the date of this recording in Anime News Network in the Buried Treasures column, which is something I read and enjoy a lot because it talks about a lot of retro anime. And while I've seen pretty much everything that Justin Tsavarkas has talked about, it's always good to, you know, read these things from someone else's point of view. And in fact, I think most of the time in any reviews or podcasts or anything, people seem to like to listen or read reviews of something they've already seen more than something that they have not seen. So I think, I don't know if he just didn't have the available time to be more in detail, but it appeared to me that perhaps he has not read the original manga, and he is, because one of the things he criticizes is the fact that the first OVA series doesn't have enough explanation in the third and fourth episode pertaining to something, which I'll get into. The first thing to establish is that the the Dominion Tank Police OVA series is quite interesting in terms of a production, because it is not just a flat-out adaptation of the manga, which is what most anime is, but in fact, if you want to see the Dominion universe chronologically, the original OVA series is in fact a prequel to the manga series. And I think this was a great idea, because I think it's a good thing for the fans, although of course, you know, if it's not written well, which fortunately this was, consider it filler and you would ignore it. But no, this was actually a prequel, and prequel to the original manga, and it's done quite effectively, because in the manga we're just sort of, these characters are thrown at us, and you know, we learn more about them as we read the manga. But this shows how the main character, which is a former Japanese bike cop called Leona Ozaki, who transfers to the tank police. That's what we see in the OVA. The first episode is, in fact, her first day of being transferred. And to a smaller extent, the trials and tribulations of being the only female in a very macho, testosterone-injected group of people, which is the tank police. So I think I'll talk about the first OVA first, because the manga occurs later on in the timeline, and the other OVAs and the other manga. So anyway, the first episode, or the first two episodes, and the episode 3 and 4, is very interesting because they were done by completely different people. And I'm not talking about the old OVA and the new OVA. I'm talking about the old OVA that suddenly was almost a complete shift, except for the voice actors in the cast. I'm not exactly sure why this was. I think it was just perhaps to show a different take. I don't think anyone was dissatisfied with the first episode, but it changes wildly in tone. Although the art director is different, the art stays pretty much completely consistent with that of throughout these four episodes. Now, the director of episodes 1 and 2, which for the UK and how I originally saw it, was titled as episode 1 or video 1, is Koichi Mashimoto, who you might not know just by his name, but to give a good example of some of the stuff he has worked on before, he's worked on Mad Lax, he's worked on that one about the punsy German guys, Mein Liebe, or whatever it's called, I don't know how to say it properly, but of course, he directed the Robin Hood TV series, which no one in the English-speaking world knows about, but it's pretty popular in France, and it was shown here, and it is still, in fact, I just saw it on TV the other day, it's shown here on TV in Hong Kong, but I'll get to that another time. But I think definitely his greatest work is the Irresponsible Space Captain Tyler, which is one of my most favorite anime TV series of all time. He was the director of the TV series and the first two episodes of the OVA series. So it's definitely someone who we know has good directing chops and has a good background in comedy, because, you know, although Tyler was done later, the comedy and that is fantastic. So he directed the first two episodes, which is about Leona Osaki's trials and tribulations of being a tank police officer at the same time where this is the first time they're introduced to Boaku, who is, it later turns out to be some android, and the Puma sisters, Ani Puma and Uni Puma, who are these android, sort of the sexy cat girl androids, which I believe they were strippers before. They were, you know, obviously built for the purpose of entertaining men, and obviously these androids are sentient and have independent thought, and they sort of wanted to escape that world and were drawn into a life of crime. So what happens is that under mysterious orders from a man known only as Mr. Big, Boaku and the Puma sisters have to raid a urine bank. Now, what is the need for a urine bank? I know it sounds strange, but it turns out that the world of Dominion, which is set in a city, a fictional city called Newport City, which, funnily enough, is also the name of the city that in the Ghost in the Shell manga, but I don't really think it bears any resemblance, because in this city of Newport and pretty much the whole world, pollution is to such an extent that there is a toxic gas cloud permanently in the sky and everyone has to wear masks out in the street. And all the buildings kind of have this interesting fungal kind of a look to them. And I suppose that's some sort of either, I think it's something to combat the toxic gas entering into the, to filter out the gas into all the buildings. So the reason they're raiding this is that apparently these urine samples, it turns out, has the samples of completely healthy specimens, those that are not affected, or those that are do not have any change in them due to the gas cloud. And most people these days, it turns out, are probably immune anyway. But the tank police sort of have to stop Boaku and from raiding any more, getting any more urine samples, which, if you read the synopsis, it sounds just insane. And when I first started getting into anime, I just remember reading the synopsis for all these different shows and thinking, wow, this is insane. And I think the highlight of the first two episodes is definitely when, and it's done in a very comedic way, when the Puma sisters and Boaku attack the hospital and get all the samples, and the SWAT team turns up, and it turns out that the SWAT team are completely inept, and that crime is to such a degree, and that the criminals have such armaments that the need for a tank police battalion is necessary. At this stage, it's just one battalion. And the girls, the Puma sisters, do this striptease, which all the SWAT team members end up watching and getting tranced by. And then, of course, finally, when they're fully under their active spell, the Puma sisters blow the crap out of all these SWAT team vans, and it's very amusing. Now, that brings me to one point about this series. The old OVA series had what is normal for a lot of 80s anime, a highly inappropriate soundtrack. Highly inappropriate. And usually I object to manga, and Manga UK were very much responsible for this more than anyone else, to ripping out different music and replacing it with their own. Street Fighter 2, the animated movie, being a prime example, among others. But this is one of the rare cases where it actually made it better, because the theme song, which I just played at the start of this promo, it's kind of this Euro beat kind of a song, as repetitive as the lyrics are, it's a much better song, and it's kind of cool, as well as the striptease song and the ending song are just much better. In the original OVA, I've got the DVD, obviously, but the OVA's, the Japanese song, is just this kind of fruity J-poppy kind of a song. It it wasn't very good. So anyway, back to the series. Leona Ozaki's told that she's going to have to transfer to child welfare by the very cool and manly Detective Britain. Commander Britain. And Commander Britain is this sort of model after a Tom Selleck-y, Burt Reynolds-y kind of action hero of... He's just pure macho and one of my favourite characters in this series. He's very dedicated to the Tank Police, almost disturbingly so. And at the same time, he's not the smartest, but he's got a lot of responsibilities. And the Tank Police are very much kind of these a ragtag group of interesting people. There's such people as Chaplin, who is this kind of, he's the religious guy, and he's always sprouting sort of religious stuff, Christian stuff. And there's Specs, who is the stereotypical four-eyed scientific guy who's a genius. And there's Mohican, who is this guy with the purple mohawk, who doesn't turn up in later OVAs. And there's the chief, who has constantly got high blood pressure, like all chiefs. And no, sorry to disappoint you, but no, he's not black, like in every cop show. But of course, this is set in Japan. But the Japan of the future is somewhat more multicultural, thus the term Dominion, I suppose. And there is also, of course, Al, who is kind of the one that loves Leona. And of course, she is completely oblivious to it, like every time. And he's just sort of the normal, noble, handsome, blonde guy. And meanwhile, Wabuaku and the Puma sisters are raiding this hospital, and the SWAT team is, you know, getting in all sorts of trouble. They're trying to interrogate a suspect with a bucket with a tied to a grenade, and the more he sort of twitches and stuff, the bucket will go further and further down until it drops and pulls the pin and blows up. These are the sort of things that the Tank Police do. They're just completely unorthodox, and it's quite funny. And of course, the chief, who is completely always under a lot of stress, it drives him nuts. And Commander Britain is pretty much responsible for most of this. I think in the manga they call him Brenton. But OVA they call him Brenton, but it's actually Britain in the manga, so I'll just keep calling him that. So to cut a long story short, it's definitely an origins kind of a show. It details their first encounter with Buaku, Leona Osaki's transferal to the Tank Police, the building of her signature tank. Because one thing about this show is the destruction. It's like Blues Brothers times a billion. They've got these tanks that just roll through the street, and they're just destroying roads and crushing buildings and lampposts and all sorts of stuff just in their wake. And Commander Britain's tank, which gets completely totaled partially due to Leona and of course Buaku, is this little clawed vehicle that digs its claws into the road and just creates a huge amount of rubble in its wake. And this is just while he's on patrol. So the city, and especially the mayor, who is also a character, is none too fond of the Tank Police because of the costs incurred in their operations. And Bonaparte is the name of Leona Osaki's tank, which it turns out is built with some of the remnants of Commander Britain's huge tank, which gets totaled and breaks his heart. And Bonaparte is this little, very small, two-man tank that can also, drive up walls. It's very versatile. It can drive up walls and fly around and do all sorts of stuff that these bulkier, standard Tank Police tanks can't do. And that's pretty much what the first two episodes are about. And the third and fourth episode sets a completely different tone. As I said, while you might not necessarily know that the staff has completely changed by looking at it. It's not like the character designs and everything are wildly different. In terms of visually, it has a consistency between four episodes. But the second video, which is parts 3 and 4 of the series, was directed by Takashi Ishiyama, who is probably definitely less known, but has also been more storyboards, but he's also directed some stuff, mostly sort of episodes. For example, Kishin Corps, which was a World War II mecha show, which was not that successful to moderately successful, depending on who you talk to. He's also the director of Maple Story, which is a Korean MMORPG which got adapted into a TV series. He also directed the Sakura Wars OVA series and the Beautiful Joe OVA series. So it's funny that episodes 3 and 4 have a much more serious, somewhat darker tone than that of 1 and 2. But Takashi Ishiyama has directed some pretty goofy stuff in his lifetime. So episodes 3 and 4 links more into the manga, because, in fact, the manga almost takes place directly after this OVA, and it involves the backstory of Buaku, who raids this museum mysteriously for no known reason. He raids a museum, and at this stage, of course, Leona Osaki is accepted and embraced among the tank police, because she's pretty manly herself, and she proved herself in the previous OVA, without spoiling much. They raid this museum where a picture entitled Innocence is sold for, like, I don't know, $100 billion or something insane. And it turns out that this is actually a picture of Buaku when he was created, so to speak. And this painting has immense value to him. And the tank police turn up while they're attacking the museum. And of course, a fight ensues, and Leona Osaki gets hit with something called a bio ball, which is something that wraps around you. It's like this little ball, and it wraps around your neck, and the more you resist, the tighter it gets. And only Buaku has the antidote. And so Leona is sort of kidnapped by Buaku. It's kind of his insurance, so he can escape with this picture. And of course, the tank police assume that, and the Puma sisters just assume that the value of this picture is in its price, which is astronomical, but it turns out it's much more than that. It turns out this picture of Buaku is also somewhat of a kind of a blueprint, which has encoded data from something called the Greenpeace experiment. And it was there that Buaku was kind of born. And this was created by a somewhat more secretive offshoot of something called the Critical Science Development Agency, which is touched upon a bit more in the manga. But essentially, they were creating something called Greenpeace, which was basically Greenpeace Chloris, which is basically this little green girl with wings, a humanoid, and a living air purifier. And this project, apparently certain laws were enacted which made what they were doing illegal, especially like the production of the sort of androids like they were making with Buaku. And the government comes in and kills everyone, and Buaku manages to escape. And due to some being at this place at the worst time, he gets in trouble with the law, and that's how he kind of becomes a criminal. And this is shown, you know, without an ounce of humor in it at all, although there still is definitely humor in the episode. Meanwhile, the Buaku gang have incurred the wrath of the Red Commandos, which are a mercenary kind of a team specifically employed by various companies to protect items of great value. So they were employed by the museum to protect this painting, specifically this painting. They even said, "We don't give a crap about anything else. You can steal whatever you want, but don't steal the painting." And then, of course, when they start to steal the painting, they go crazy. And the Red Commandos are these very high-tech group of people. And at the same time, Commander Britain gets gravely insulted by one of them when he makes fun of the tank police. And they basically said, "Our job is to get the painting back. If you get in our way, we'll kill you too." So they're not on good terms with either side. And throughout the series, we sort of follow the Red Commandos and their tracking down of Buaku, which also puts Leona at risk. So that gives the tank police another reason to fight back. So the question, of course, is, will Buaku keep his promise, which was if Leona gets him to safety, he has a spray which can get the bio ball off her neck and just let him leave with the painting. So will he live up to that promise? And when the final confrontation happens, which of course it does, and it's a very awesome, well-done confrontation between a standoff, a John Woo-esque standoff, or a Sergio Leone-esque standoff, between the Red Commandos, the Tank Police, and the Buaku Gang, who all have reasons to wipe each other out. And of course, the very fact that this is a prequel, and there is a continuing manga series, and there is a continuing OVA, and there is another continuing manga series, pretty much means that, yes, Leona does indeed live. Now, again, this was a manga dub done by Studio 21, I believe, which worked directly for Manga Video in the UK, because Manga Video was originally based in the UK. That's where the central office is or whatever. And they used... they're infamous for having profanity-laden soundtracks or dubbings, which, you know, maybe to give it a cooler or more of a adult edge. And the extent at which they put swearing into their soundtracks is really insane. Check a previous review of Cyber City Oedo, which had an awesome dub. That is the one thing about Manga Video. I think that a lot of their dubs actually rank upon some of the best, because I know some of the actors involved in these dubs, and some of them do come from sort of theatrical backgrounds or good acting backgrounds. And so the dubs, in terms of acting quality, rank upon some of the best dubs ever, at least in my opinion. And it seems to be the general opinion that a lot of people think some earlier dubs are in fact better, strangely enough. The voice of Leona Ozaki is done by, the English voice, is done by Tony Barry, who is a veteran of the English version of the Moomin Valley series, which is considered a classic in Asia. It's based on a Finnish novel, I believe. But the Moomin Valley, from a marketing point of view, definitely is still a huge hit. And it was never as well received in the in America, certainly. I don't even know if it aired in America. But I instantly recognized her voice from that. But she's also done a lot of stuff for Manga Video, like the Project Echo dub, the Lupin the Third, The Secret of Mamo. She played Fujiko in that. And also Goodbye Lady Liberty. She played Haruko, the main character in Rōjin Z, or Rōjin Z, done by Katsuhiro Otomo, of course. And while at first her voice is a little bit high-pitched, and it takes her a while to get into the character, but I think she does a very good job once she sort of settles into the character. And I think one problem with dubs in general is that people have been used to doing voice acting for these sort of cartoons for children, which has a very... there's a sort of a patronizing tone, even when it's trying to be serious, for kids' shows or kids' cartoons. A kind of way of speaking. And with anime, where it's supposed to be for more mature audiences or a more diverse amount of audiences, there's none of that there should not be that patronizing kind of tone. And I know this sounds strange, but a good example would be, say, okay, here's a good example. In anime show A, the character is supposed to say, "Where did you get that?" So you have to make it sound sort of natural, you know. "Where'd you get that?" No, that didn't sound natural at all. "Where'd you get that?" Something like that. But the American, or sorry, the sort of Disney school of dubbing, I don't know what to call it, would be something like, "Where did you get it?" You see that kind of patronizing kind of tone? That is a problem with a lot of early, and still a problem with dubs today, is they still have that perfectly acceptable tone for cartoons, for like American children's shows or something, but it doesn't really work in the context of what is being dubbed. So, but for the most part, for this show, they do it very well. And the shining star is definitely Sean Barrett. Now, Sean Barrett is also British. That is just his dub name, I believe. I think his stage name is something different, and I believe I've seen him in several things because the voice is very easy to distinguish. And he is a veteran of a lot of Hong Kong dubs. That is Jackie Chan films that came out in England and they dubbed it in English. He was definitely a veteran of that sort of a thing, which is strange because live-action dubs usually rank among the worst in the world. But I think that aspect is that, of course, the film is not just for children. So if you were to do a good dubbing job, which he certainly does, it doesn't have that kind of patronizing tone that people who are more veterans of the sort of American kids shows or English kids shows have. So he plays Commander Britain, and he does a fantastic job. And in fact, I even heard that Masamune Shirow preferred the English voiceover for Commander Britain than the Japanese one. It is not hard to see why.
"Lieutenant, are we supposed to question suspects this way? Is this by the book, Lieutenant?"
"Listen, kid, there's two things a policeman needs. He's got to be smart and he's got to have balls."
Sean Barrett also played Gogol from Cyber City Oedo, which we reviewed a little while ago, and he did a very good job of that. And I'm surprised he wasn't in more stuff. It's very difficult to find stuff about older dub actors, but I do know that he has a very good relationship with the Jim Henson Creature Workshop, and he's done a lot of stuff in either productions like Labyrinth. He did several voices in Labyrinth, which is one of my favorite films of all time also, and as well as The Dark Crystal, which is also another classic, and Return to Oz, which was not a Henson film, but I believe they used creatures created by him, so he was definitely in good with them. The rest of the act also do a good job.
"What do you want, baby? You're trespassing on a men's party."
"It's pretty unfriendly in here. I'm not impressed, and that's an understatement."
"Sorry if you find us a little rough. So what can the Tank Police do for you?"
"Sir, Officer Leone Ozaki transferred to the Tank Police from the City Motorcycle Headquarters Unit."
"They send us a girl?"
And there seems to be a lot of connections between this and Cyber City Oedo, because a lot of the actors in this ended up voicing people in Oedo. The voice of Buaku also voiced Dave Kurokawa, who was the one of the bad guys in the first episode of Cyber City Oedo. He voiced Buaku. So kudos to him, because I could not have guessed that by listening to it, because Buaku has sort of this hoarse, rough, bellowing kind of voice, where Dave Kurokawa was this sort of this sniveling, scaredy little nerdy, not nerdy, but sort of this insidious little sniveling character. So certainly a good job there. Most of these are stage names, so a lot of the actors don't have credits beyond even just the Tank Police series. Also, special kudos to the voice actress for the who played both the Puma sisters, Alison Dowling, who does not have any credits beyond this that I can see, at least under the same stage name, so to speak. And she did a very good job. She gave the Puma sisters a very necessary, sexy voice. And, you know, it could be argued that if you wanted to keep it loyal, you could give them these high-pitched, squeaky, cutie Japanese voices. But in terms of English sexiness, I suppose we could say she did a very good job. And she even gave them this slight southern accent. It's hard to explain, but I think, I don't know, I liked it, and I thought it was pretty sexy, and they also did a good job. Strong but sexy. And here's another great bit from the dub, and also the new music they included. This is the striptease scene.
You can't escape! Lay down your weapons and surrender!
I didn't bring this machine gun to surrender!
Hey, don't you just love being in the spotlight?
I don't remember having such a big audience in a long time, do you?
You haven't forgotten the routine.
You bet I haven't.
To the manga. Now, I did touch upon the manga entitled just Dominion when Masamune Shiro was the anime person of the week, which is a segment we don't do that much, or I don't do that much. And the manga, which was domestically released in the USA by Dark Horse Comics and released as a compilation volume, which is that is the one I own, is what I'm basing this review of the manga off. Is definitely Shiro in fine form. Shiro at his best. Shiro at his least techno-rambling and least pretentious. For more of that version of Shiro, read, say, Ghost in the Shell Man-Machine Interface. And to slightly a lesser extent, the latter Dominion manga, which I'll talk about soon. And the manga contains a few little... like the Ghost in the Shell manga, where there's an overall arching storyline and a few little side things. Now, something that Shiro does very well is he does ambience very well. He has the pictures with a lot of detail, showing, like, the police, the tank police HQ. Lots of little onomatopoeia in the background, tap, 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 tap. And not only that, people whispering and saying silly little things, but it's not just... for one panel, he sort of has these little mini conversations going on in the background, sometimes between the main characters, sometimes between people who are not really, not featured at all in it. And it does bring a great sense of atmosphere. I think Shiro is one of the best people at putting a sort of atmosphere onto the paper. And it, as I said, it follows directly after the OVA series. At this stage, Buwaku has already acquired Greenpeace and still basically causing trouble, and the tank police have been requested by the science agency that I mentioned before, which is the Critical Science Development Agency, who are real pricks, it turns out, because Specs, one of the characters, gets transferred, or they want him to become a part of the team. And for Specs, who is this sort of nerdy character, it's a dream come true. And it turns out that they just wanted him to get his ideas and put their name on it, and then he gets discharged back to the tank police. And the plot essentially involves more chasing after Buaku in the streets of Newport City, and also more revelations about Greenpeace, as well as a few little side stories in between. You know, Al trying to win Leona's heart, but Leona has somewhat of an unnatural attachment to her tank Bonaparte, very much so. And the manga is just Shiro at his best, again, as I've already said, and quite close to the original Ghost in the Shell manga, which had a lot of funny moments. Dominion does have a lot of funny moments also, and it's much more of a comedy than, say, the original Ghost in the Shell. And there were enough funny moments in the Ghost in the Shell manga to at least put comedy in the subgenre or sub-tag. And I think one issue that's touched upon in the manga a lot more than the original OVA series is the fact that the tank police are not very well liked at all, and the mayor is always breathing down the chief of the tank police's back. And that is one another great thing of the dub in the original OVA. There's a long sort of argument between the chief and the mayor, which happens during the sort of the some of the opening credits, and it's just done so wonderfully. And it sort of shows you a serious look at the considerations of having oversized tanks in a futuristic metropolis. But something, as I said, something that is touched upon in this manga is the inherent dislike of the tank police a lot of the public has, seeing as they're always blowing stuff up and costing the taxpayers a lot of money, and they have to deal with a group called the Citizens Against Destructive Police, or CADP. And they're led by a woman known as the District Prosecutor, who is Leona's worst nightmare. In fact, she turns up as a nightmare later on in a branching manga, because Dominion was not so big in terms of its size, and as we know, Shiro pumps stuff out and then just disappears for a while. There was another manga shortly after it, and called Dominion Phantom of the Audience, which is just a small side story which involves something similar. Now, it should be said that if you're wondering about Buaku and you're interested in him from the OVA, his character definitely, there's definitely resolutions in terms of his character. Nothing is left unresolved. It's not so much meant to be episodic and, oh, Buaku this week and Buaku this volume, Buaku next volume. It's not like that at all. There is a resolution, and I'm certainly not spoiling something by telling you that, because it's not something you would expect, okay? And he is not in the future installments of the manga for a very good reason. And that makes Dominion better, I think. While I like Buaku, and I think, you know, him and the Puma sisters are sort of cool characters, I'm more interested in, you know, the daily lives of these sort of futuristic policemen with these pretty strange and somewhat silly tanks. I want to see the variety of different operations that they have to do. I want to see all the little sort of office politics and things like that. And that is dealt with to a certain extent. In fact, it's dealt with very well to a certain extent. And I think that this is what makes the next OVA series such a treat, because the next OVA series is much closer to Shiro's original brain, you could say, his original design. The OVA sports designs that are very, very much like Shiro's original designs, and is much more closer in tone to the original manga. Now, the new OVA series, which I first found about in the Australian Museum of Contemporary Arts in 1995, they had, or Sydney Museum of Contemporary Art or whatever, they had an exhibition about adult or animation, or just sort of animation in general, but it focused very much on the fact that animation is not just for kids. They had a lot of Ralph Bakshi stuff there. They had a lot of anime stuff there. And back in 1995, you know, before the internet was the thing, to see all this stuff was just wonderful. And one of the things I saw there was something called Dominion Prussia Police. Like, I saw a Japanese poster for it. And I'm like, oh my goodness, there is more Tank Police. And it turns out it came out in the UK later on under the name of Dominion Crusher Police. And back then we didn't have any fan subs, or certainly not in Australia. So it wasn't like, oh, I can get the fan sub. It was like, oh my gosh, I hope this gets licensed. Back then licensing was almost life or death for anime fans. And I first found out about it there, and eventually it did come out, and of course I bought them all. And in between that time, I'd already read all the mangas. And I actually bought the Phantom of the Audience manga in the US, because it wasn't anywhere to be seen in Australia. But during a holiday, I went to a big comic shop, which blew me away, because it was much bigger in size and scope, and the anime scene on VHS was already exploding there. So it was certainly a dream come true for an anime fan. But anyway, the new OVA series is done by a completely different team, different character designer, different music, different writer. This time, both the character designs, which are clearly an homage to Masamune Shiro's character designs, as I've already said, is someone called Noboru Furuse, who did is mostly a character designer. He, as I said, he did the character designer for this, but he's also done some directing before. Most notably, he directed JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, the 1993 OVA series, not the newer one. So beyond that, he's done pretty much next to nothing in terms of directing, but he certainly did a good job. And I think if you've seen the 1993 OVA series of JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, you will also agree without having had to have seen this OVA. Now, again, this OVA is much more action-packed than the previous one. The animation and the character designs and the detail is also substantially better. It seems that the budget was bigger, obviously, although I'm not dissing the previous OVA at all. It's certainly a classic, and it did well enough in the animation and character design department anyway, but I just think that this has a level of detail that I more associated with sort of Shiro stuff than the previous one. And on visually alone, it's beautiful. And this time Buwaku is not in the series at all, and it follows the Tank Police, again Leona Osaki, and Al, you know, the guy that's always chasing her, Commander Britain. Most of the regular cast and crew are here again, and including the English dub voice actors all retain their roles, although this was done quite a few years later, I believe, the dub, but they managed to round up everyone. So I think it also can show us how good this dub was, that they were willing to get all these people back this much later. Now, the storyline for this one, while still retaining a lot of funny parts or comedic parts from the mangas, is much more like Ghost in the Shell. In fact, the feeling is a lot more like Ghost in the Shell, like Standalone Complex, I think, with a little bit more humor in it. It deals with political intrigue, international political intrigue, mechas, and sort of investigation and stuff like that. So the tone at times can be quite serious, but I think overall it's still very much a funny show. Yet at the same time, we've got sort of these mechs fighting the Tank Police, and Leona, sort of her little Bonaparte tank flying all over the place. It's very exciting. So if you like the sort of the Tajikoma action from Ghost in the Shell Standalone Complex, you'll certainly like this. And I think in styles and thematically, it's very similar to the Standalone Complex series. Again, slightly funnier. So this OVA is 6 episodes long. Episode 1 reintroduces us to the Tank Police, and it captures the ambient feel that the manga conveys very well. You see a lot more of the Tank Police office and the sort of the crap they have to put up with, and a few new characters. And it starts off with a funeral procession in the streets, and someone attempts to flee the scene of a crime in the middle of this funeral procession, and Leona Ozaki chases after him and blows a few buildings up and ends up arresting him. And it turns out that this funeral was for a public figure, and that the mayor, who was always breathing down the tank police's neck, was there to see it. At the same time, to compound the problem, a new transferred officer, Ishigawa, says that there are more better, more politically correct ways to deal with crimes in general. And the tank police don't like him much at all. In fact, Leona Ozaki calls him an arrogant little prick. And at the same time, this spider-like mech starts invading the city, very highly advanced, more advanced than the tanks, obviously. And it turns out that this is somewhat of a test run by some evil corporation, and they're using the tank police as their lab rats. And the chase and the fight involved is very well animated, very exciting, and very well done. Again, reminiscent of the Tachikoma fights in Ghost in the Shell. It's somewhat tactical, and for the thinking man's action, it certainly does a good job. Episode 2 reintroduces us to the Puma sisters, who are still in this. In fact, they're in every version of a Dominion that has come out thus far. Of course, Shiro is not going to get rid of the sexy cat girls. The Puma sisters witness a murder, which turns out to be the good friend of Leona Ozaki back in her motorbike cop days, and she decides to go out and investigate this by herself. The chief does not give her any permission to do so, so she says, okay, fine, I quit. Of course, we always know what happens when that happens in a cop show. And then the chief says, okay, look, I'm worried about her. Britain, you go follow her. And Britain, who is a brash man of action, can certainly not the stealthy type. He's used to going in there, tanks and guns blazing, and it's quite amusing seeing him try to follow her. In fact, it's one of the funniest parts of the series. And eventually Leona gets deeper into this and realizes who it was or what it was that killed her friend, and she gets kidnapped and almost killed until the tank police come to their rescue. And the Puma sisters this time are not so much a force of bad, although they never really were that. You could never hate them, but they are certainly more like the informants that live on the dark side of society yet have a heart of gold, I guess, you know, like in every cop show. And episode 3 follows a truck, and this is something similar like this happened on a Ghost in the Shell episode. A truck rigged up with explosives, enough explosives to destroy almost the entire city, is driving straight for the city center, and the tank police have to figure out a way to stop it. Definitely a tense and well-done episode, although at times you might miss some of the more slower parts showing the sort of fun ambience and stuff going on in the office, because it's a very fast-paced episode. Now, along the halfway point, we start to realize that pretty much all these incidents are related, and I don't want to say too much because I don't want to spoil the show for you. Essentially, it turns out that a company called Dainippon Research, or something along those lines, was developing these weapons for testing against the tank police, and for various reasons, which I won't go into in the series, they have targeted the mayor as well. And they've got a whole terrorist organization under their wing, which is doing their stuff for them. And the remainder of the series very much focuses on their war with the tank police. And it's much more action-packed, again, than the OVA that preceded it. But it's also, I think, much more accessible if your only exposure to Shiro is Ghost in the Shell. This is definitely a good bridging path. You don't need to have read the manga or the OVA series that preceded it to enjoy this. And I think this is more true for this OVA series than any other subsequent version of Dominion out there, like the mangas, the OVAs and whatnot. Obviously, if you read the manga, which was made first, you're going to get everything. But I mean, if you were to, say, pick up a volume somewhere in the middle of the manga series. Now, after this, Dominion was seemingly, put to rest. It had done a wonderful job of entertaining people and certainly had a special place in my heart. And then Shiro said, okay, I'm going to make more. And everyone said, yay! And he said, okay, it's called Dominion, Conflict, No More Noise. Now, this is kind of where Masamune Shiro gets into his crazy techno-rambling pretentious stage, which I talk about all the time. I will say that the manga is a pretty good manga for the most part, actually, because he's still not fully gone into that stage yet. But it shows a lot of traits which are things that completely ruined Ghost in the Shell Man-Machine interface for me. Lots of linear notes for silly stuff. I mean, Captain Britain is holding this gun, and he also says this in Intron Depot, his art book, which is very good. He said, I know the barrel is 1 centimeter smaller, the clip is actually blah, 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 and I know that the gun wouldn't really do this. Please forgive me, it just sort of looked cool, and I know that the recoil might, you know, the gloves he's wearing aren't good enough for the recoil of his gun, and he might fracture his wrist if a gun with that sort of a barrel side, blah, 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 full of this sort of techno babble. And if you have to read linear notes for every single little thing that the author puts in there, it brings you in and out and in and out of this kind of world, and it's not just going through the fourth wall, it's shattering all the walls, and you just can't, I don't know, it disrupts your concentration or your escapism in the manga, so to speak. And another thing that kind of pissed me off, and Shiro is no exception, nor is anyone, because this happens all the time in anime. He says, oh, well, look, I want to make this in... I'd be sort of happy if you would consider this a different universe to the original Dominion, because I've changed around a few things, and, you know, it might not be compatible with the older series. So that alone kind of annoyed me, you know. Why do you have to set it in another universe? Why do you even have to say that? Just let people make up their own thing, because I always hate watching stuff that's set in a different universe. But luckily it can be taken as a sequel, and that's how I take it for the most part. Unfortunately, Al, the blonde-haired, blue-eyed fellow that is in love with Leona and was, you know, I enjoyed the whole Al subplot. He's completely absent from this series, no explanation given. Someone that loves Leona and their relationship develops as the mangas and the OVAs go along, and then he's just completely absent from there. So they said, okay, we know she loves a tank, let's just go with that. Now, the tank police are now much larger than they were before. They were just a single battalion, sort of experimental, but now it's like a SWAT team. That means there's lots of different tank police battalions now, and they're just one of them. Leona Ozaki is now a commander of her own unit of interesting people, admittedly, including sort of this big, gruff family guy and a guy in a sort of a wheelchair. And one of the Puma sisters becomes a secretary for the tank police. So that's how they included her. And Commander Britain is also, you know, commanding his own unit, and he's on sort of an equal level with Leona now, so that the interactions between them is much more interesting. And for the most part, while, like I said, it's a very good manga, I think, or it's quite good, it's got this sort of rambling quality to it, and there's certain characters that cause sort of annoyance to Leona, that, and the way they go about this is they, a lot of this sort of coy dialogue and office politics and stuff like that. And while I personally enjoy it, a lot of people aren't going to be really into this sort of rambling chit-chat. It's so strange to see in a comic where each panel or each word is supposed to be something somewhat critical, I suppose. And I just think that it gives you rambling stuff or little bits of conversation that are not normal for even novels, let alone graphic novels. Also, Bonaparte tanks, which Leona drove in the original, they're now sort of mass-produced. There's a lot more of them. And the bulk of the story involves Leona's kind of battle with a corrupt arms dealer who wants to get the city's contracts on manufacturing new tank-like things for the tank police, including Leona Ozaki's training and relationship with her new rookie recruits. One of the Puma sisters is also a rookie recruit, so that's sort of interesting. But unfortunately, it just stops. Shiro says, okay, I'm going to take a bit of a break with this. I think he said this, you know, once this thing had been compiled into one big volume. He said, I know it's taken a while. I might do another one when I feel like it, maybe 2 years, 3 years. And that has since turned into 10 years. And there's no continuation in sight. So I don't know why he just decided not to do it, but it seems that this story will remain unfinished. It's still worth a read, and there is still somewhat of a conclusion to certain aspects of the story, but you're left wanting, and that's a shame. Something that tried to address this was an OVA series that was released about a year ago, done with sort of the Apple Seed-esque 3D CGI shading, toon shading, but done not as well. And even the original Appleseed film was not done so well, something we've talked about before. And it just involved one small case. And it was done independently, part of sort of a special grant for young filmmakers or new filmmakers in Japan. I forget the guy's name. It was something like Ferrari, or some strange name that he went by. And it was called Tank SWAT 01. And it was certainly nothing special at all. In fact, it was quite disappointing. So I don't think that'll ever be commercially released. I don't even know if it was that big a hit in Japan. I think it was something where we were anticipating a sequel, but maybe it just wasn't successful enough to warrant one. So the future of Dominion lies definitely in doubt, as it has been for a long time. Although the very fact that they decided to make an OVA this much later says something about the strength of the series. So, in conclusion, Dominion, original OVA, definitely a classic. The manga, excellent, very good. The second OVA series, probably my favorite of all incantations of the Tank Police. And Dominion No More Noise is for fans only. Very good if you like the series. Definitely an acquired taste. And the OVA series, third OVA series, Tank SWAT 01. If you're curious, download it, but don't feel like you're missing out on something if you don't. So that's pretty much it. And that was one of the most exhausting hours of my entire life.
All right, boy, so that wraps up another sensational episode of Anime Pacific. Dane, I really loved your segment on
Dominion Tank Police, eh?
Yes, that was great. I'm sure Dane will add in the comments after. And I hope we'll be able to get back to a regular show next week. So until next time, goodbye.
Bye-bye, everybody. Bye-bye.
see you die.